From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Today, who is affected by Michigan's new abortion law?
I think the insurance industry is still trying to figure this law out, just like everybody else is. They've never had to deal with a situation like this, and they really don't know exactly what to do.
And a group of doctors in Michigan is working to prevent gun violence.
We can't lose people just every day like we are right now.
The founders join us to discuss why they decided to speak up. And then a father's story on life with his autistic son.
It certainly is hard having someone in the intimate space of your home who has a cognitive disability and trying to bridge that difference. But if that was the only narrative of the story, then we've all lost.
Those stories and much, much more. From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in today for Cynthia Canty. On the 41st anniversary of Roe v. Wade, women's reproductive rights are in the spotlight here in Michigan. That's as insurance providers and consumers are trying to understand Michigan's new controversial law, the one requiring separate policies for abortion coverage. On today's show, we'll get a better understanding of how the new law is supposed to work. And then we'll travel to space. Okay, I'm over-promising a bit, but we will meet a group of researchers who want to make it easier for tiny satellites to do just that. But first, we travel to Lansing, where lawmakers are in the midst of debate over how teachers in Michigan should be evaluated. Hearings were held today at the state capitol, and Jake Neer, reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network, was there. Hi, Jake.
Hey, Zoe.
So there's this bipartisan package of bills in front of this education committee. What's in them?
Well, this is kind of going off of what the Michigan Council for Educator Effectiveness put together in terms of recommendations last year. Lawmakers had a long process of putting together a teacher tenure reform bill a couple years ago. Part of that was making sure that they had a way to evaluate teachers, how good what kind of job they were doing across the state. And so this council put together a series of recommendations, very detailed. And this is the legislative part of that, trying to get them through the legislature and get a system in place as soon as possible.
So what did you hear today at these hearings?
Well, the goal is supposed to be to get teachers to not necessarily be punitive, because we've been hearing a lot about, if teachers aren't effective, they should be fired, or their pay should be decreased or increased based on how effective they are. When the report came out, the commission said, we don't want to be dealing with that. We want to be positive here, right? We want to make everyone happy and give them the tools they need to be successful instead of cracking the whip. So everyone seems to be pretty encouraged by the fact that these bills have sort of, at least what members of the committee are saying is that these bills provide a good starting point for that. But it should be mentioned also that if teachers or administrators who are also going to be assessed with the new system, if it gets passed, can be fired if they persistently get low scores on their evaluations. So there is a punitive component to this, but the goal is supposed to be let's be positive here.
Well, so back in the fall when the recommendations first came out, one of the issues was this idea of not tying teacher salaries directly to student performance. So it sounds like that is not part of this. But what is then? How would teachers be evaluated?
It's a list of different criteria that would be put together. There are two major components of it. The first is, basically observation, getting input from a variety of sources on how teachers are doing, including administrators. Also some talk about getting feedback from students and other, people who work with these teachers on a regular basis. But the other component of it is standardized tests, and that's something that the state is working on trying to put in place right now. We're moving away from the MEEP test that so many people in Michigan are familiar with, But they're trying to decide exactly what to replace that with, and whatever test gets put in place will play a big role in this. And but opponents of the state's new standards, the Common Core standards, and also a lot of the tests and exams that we're thinking about replacing the MEEP with.
These are the smarter balanced assessments.
The smarter balanced assessment, yes. These are the guys that are most concerned about the evaluation system, it seems like, because they don't want to, be putting teachers in a position where a big portion of their job evaluation is based on these things that they don't like. That's a balancing act to play. But one way they've dealt with that is they're going to try to phase in the standardized test component over a couple of years. It's not right away, half of your teacher evaluation is based on standardized tests. They're going to try to start off easy on that and then sort of phase in, how much weight that has.
Jake Neer, reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network, at Education Committee hearings today in the State House looking at teacher evaluations. Jake, thanks so much.
Thanks, Zoe.
Technology has opened the doors in recent years for do-it-yourselfers to complete scientific projects without help from universities or big government agencies. But space exploration is one field that has remained largely out of reach for amateur scientists, those who don't have NASA-sized budgets. Well, now a group of researchers at the University of Michigan is hoping to change that. They want to take tiny satellites and give them a push in a new direction. Stateside's John K. Wilson has more.
Exploring the solar system isn't something that a lot of people get a chance to take part in. It's complicated and really expensive. But in the last few years, space enthusiasts and amateur scientists have found a way to get more involved. They're doing it by building little satellites themselves. They're called CubeSats. J.P. Sheehan is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Michigan School of Engineering, and he's part of a team of researchers working with these little CubeSats.
Sort of a new idea in space exploration. Instead of making a satellite the size of a truck, we make it the size of a loaf of bread.
They're basically just metal boxes. They're popular in the DIY space community because they're built with off-the-shelf parts. They can be stuffed with cameras and all sorts of other instruments, depending on the builder's interests. And by space travel standards, at least, CubeSats are cheap. Thousands of dollars compared to the hundreds of millions spent on NASA projects. Sheehan estimates that in the past 10 years or so, 150 of these CubeSats have been put into orbit. They're usually put together by groups of amateurs or classes who pay to have their CubeSat catch a ride on bigger rocket missions. They're used as ballast cargo and get dropped off on the way. Once they're up there, they stay in orbit and transmit pictures or other data back down to Earth. But as cool as it is for citizen scientists to have their own satellites circling the planet, Sheehan says that CubeSats still have some serious limits. They're kind of stuck in a rut.
Right now, the door opens out of the rocket. These things get spat out into space and tumble in the orbit that they're left in. They can't go anywhere else.
That's where Sheehan and the other U of M researchers come in.
What a thruster would enable is for them to change orbit, even to leave Earth's orbit, and to go explore the solar system.
Sheehan showed me around the university's Plasma Dynamics and Electric Propulsion Laboratory.
This is the large vacuum test facility. It's a big vacuum chamber. It's 9 meters in diameter, or 9 meters long, 6 meters in diameter.
The lab's main attraction is a massive vacuum chamber. Imagine a two-story propane tank tipped on its side. Scientists use it to simulate the emptiness of space and test plasma propulsion systems for spacecraft, like big communication satellites. But recently, Sheehan's been using a much smaller chamber on the other side of the room. He's working to take the technology that moves big spacecraft and shrink it down to fit the CubeSats that amateurs build themselves. Normally, university projects like this one seek funding from corporations and foundations, but Sheehan says those grants are extremely competitive and can take years. Instead, the U of M team reached out directly to the DIY types who could use this technology. This past summer, they raised over $96,000 from donors on Kickstarter.
Most of the supporters that we had were these sort of people who always dreamed of being an astronaut when they were kids, and to some degree haven't lost that dream. And now that space exploration is becoming more cheap, it's attainable in some way.
So what could citizen scientists actually do with a fleet of tiny satellites they can move around? Sheehan says the possibilities are wide open. They range from the practical, like helping farmers monitor soil moisture or tracking forest fires in real time, to the far out.
And in fact, that there are a number of extremely exciting places that simply haven't been explored. The moons of Jupiter are a prime example of that. There's a possibility for that life could exist on Europa. It's something that no one has actually looked at yet.
With the money they raised on Kickstarter, Sheehan and the team are finishing a workable prototype they plan to test in space by late 2014. But Sheehan warns that it could be a lot longer before amateur scientists can start driving their CubeSats around. Once the U of M team proves their thrusters actually work in space, the government gets involved. And they can place limits on how the university shares their design. But Sheehan is optimistic that with increasing public interest in DIY space exploration, these laws could change. It won't be tomorrow, but the way technology is moving, Sheehan says it's conceivable that major new discoveries about our solar system will be made by amateurs building their own spacecraft and looking for their own slice of the final frontier.
That was Stateside's John K. Wilson. Okay, so we're all starting to sound a little like broken records around here, but I'm going to say it anyway. It's cold. Bitterly cold weather, and Michigan seem to have developed a relationship this month. They just can't get enough of each other. This morning, the National Weather Service put it at 17 degrees below zero in Ann Arbor, 15 below in Port Huron, 18 below in Alpena. And please don't shoot the messenger, but the bitter cold is expected to last at least for a few more days, and more lake effect snow is expected along parts of Lake Superior in the UP. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. What can a parent do to reach an autistic child, to create some path through the barrier of autism spectrum disorder that might somehow lead to greater understanding of that child's mind and soul? That challenge is facing more and more families in the U.S. The National Center for Health Statistics estimates that one out of every 50 school-age kids has the condition. Behind those statistics, though, are the day-to-day stories of families coping with the often crushing challenge of autism spectrum disorder. One such family is the Mills family of Kalamazoo. Bruce Mills is a professor of English at Kalamazoo College, and he's the father of an autistic son, 21-year-old Jacob. Bruce's memoir of his family's journey is called An Archaeology of Yearning. Cindy recently spoke with Bruce about his book.
Why did you use an archaeological excavation as the framework for telling your family's story and Jacob's story?
Arriving at that idea actually was when the book took clear shape. I realized I wanted to try to understand the journey we were having with Jacob. And it was a journey that couldn't be told in something really simple. And when I thought of archaeology, I thought you have to first have something surface.
Mm-hmm.
Something comes to you. But there's a breadth and depth to understanding what that may be. So with the simple stories that I might remember with Jacob, it became more than narrating what happened. It was, well, how do I understand that in a context that has some breadth and depth, including other people's stories of their experiences with autism?
And you, as I read your book, it seems that even though it's telling us the story of Jacob and his autism, it really is more a story of your entire family, the communication amongst yourselves, and your journey with autism, you and your wife Mary, your daughter Sarah, and Jacob together.
Yes, I think that's important. It's a family story, my story, because I'm telling it, it's my angle on the story. But just in relationship to my son, my daughter's experience, for instance, it was important for me to have a whole section focusing solely on my daughter's experiences with autism in addition to my own, because she's going to be with my son longer than what my wife and I will be with my son.
That is, I'm sure, a burden that never goes away once a parent realizes that they have a child who is special needs and you know that you're going to be gone, and then what?
Yeah, and why I told the story, why I wanted to tell the story too, is a move from burden to something else, something that could be understood as being beautiful, something understood as getting beyond what is hard to address. It certainly is hard when having someone in the intimate space of your home who has a cognitive disability and trying to bridge that difference. That's a challenge. But if that was the only narrative of the story, then we've all lost. So it was how to wrap language around my son's experience, my experience with my son, my daughter's experience, in a way that, yes, we recognize the challenge, but that's not the story. Again, it's that archaeological dig. There's a greater yearning, a greater desire to connect out there. How do I capture that in this memoir? Let me tell you a story.
Yeah.
When my son was younger, he wouldn't hug us. We couldn't hug him. The sensory effect of that meant he moved away. So we weren't, in the language we expected of connection, we weren't getting it. And that can be a despairing thing for a parent, especially for a child. But my son would back into us. He'd climb on top of me, and I'd play. In other words, there's another way in which you can understand what intimacy is, what love is. If I got stuck in what I needed, I would lose my son.
Wow.
But it doesn't have to be the way in which I needed it.
And you have to learn that. You have to learn what that new direction is.
Yeah, you have to learn it. And there's a part in the book where I talk about one of the hardest things is when you start a journey, you have to understand you may go into it and you may not be the same person when you come out. Mm. That can be a frightening thing. So I had to give up, and people, I think, have to give up a way in which they understand and process the world if you're going to have a connection with any kind of difference, but certainly with a cognitive difference where my son is, again, processing the world in a way that's different the way in which I might process the world.
And speaking of the beginning of a journey, I'd like to ask you to read us an excerpt from your book. And this is when you took Jacob in to be assessed by a team of experts just before he turned three. But before you read it, what had been happening that prompted you to want to have your son evaluated?
One of the most dramatic things that happened, he lost language. So he had acquired 18 to 24 words around the time in which you have language acquisition, a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And then over the next year, he stopped using language. And then he started doing a lot of repetitive kind of play, lining up toys. I'm a teacher, as you said, at Kalamazoo College, and I'd have students over, and he'd put chairs in a row, and he'd have them sit in the chairs as if they're an audience. So the play had a ritualistic repetition to it that was endearing, but seemed limiting. And so we had a sense then that something developmentally was unusual. In the winter prior to his third birthday, Mary and I had Jacob assessed by a speech therapist, a social worker, a psychologist, and an occupational therapist at Croydon. I remember watching him go through the physical tests and table play with a sense of pride as Mary joined the psychologist behind the one-way mirror in an adjoining room. I sat just off his shoulder, encouraging him, following him from toy to toy. I had to fight the urge to offer a running narrative of my son's seemingly special behaviors. Jacob likes to arrange magnetic letters like movie credits. He has great balance. He lines up toys for hours. After the formal testing, as we all got ready to leave, Jacob noticed a mirror standing against the wall. He was fascinated with his image in it. He danced and walked back and forth in front of the tall length of glass. The act seemed so childlike that I enjoyed the play of it until I noticed the two observers exchange glances. 2 weeks later, the psychologist on the assessment team met with us at our home. She indicated that Jacob had been diagnosed as autistic. Calmly and gently, she reviewed the report, underscoring why his behaviors indicated autism. She especially noted the language deficits and the tendency to lose words. She recommended some readings, suggesting that when we were ready, we could review the materials that discuss the long-term possibilities. She said that autism was not curable. It was a lifelong condition. She noted that because Jacob appeared to be so high-functioning, he might especially benefit from early and intensive educational interventions to build vocabulary and learn social skills. When she left, Mary and I sat at the table, glancing at the materials before us. We did not want to say goodbye to the Jacob we had imagined forward in time, the brother who would accompany his sister to the same schools, who would converse with her about teachers they might have shared. In our mind's eye, we caught glimpses of this unimagined child when he grew into awkward manhood, and then we wept for him and for ourselves. We had no story for this moment and this place.
That's Bruce Mills, professor of English at Kalamazoo College, reading from his memoir, An Archaeology of Yearning, the story of his family's journey with his son Jacob's autism. And Bruce, that moment has basically, as you say, taken the life that every parent envisions when a baby is born. So the life you had envisioned for Jacob, it's blown up. So how do you point yourself in a new direction when, as you write, we had no story for this moment in this place? Where do you start?
Well, I think for me it took some time. It wasn't that I didn't embrace Jacob for who he was or who he is. But, yeah, like you said, I didn't. We have the stories of when we were growing up and how we experienced youth. So not having those images of what it means to develop meant that I had to go looking. And one thing I did as someone who's a curious reader and someone who teaches is I went and I read about other people's experiences. I also joined the Autism Society and was involved. So it was important for me to hear how people, parents mm-hmm. experienced their life with autism.
Talk about your circle of family and friends. How did Jacob's diagnosis affect the way they regarded your son?
I think we were very fortunate because I think sometimes there can be a falling away of friends. And in part, that's not anyone's fault. It's that early years with my son meant it was kind of isolating. We couldn't go out because it was difficult for him to go out given the sensory overload. And so we lost touch. So I think one of the things that was important for us is that friends who allowed Jacob to be Jacob, allowed a meltdown to happen early on in the early years, and were willing to listen to our repetitions, yeah. our endless stories about what was happening, good and bad. I think the other thing that's been important to us is Kalamazoo community has been tremendously supportive in its resources, school, teachers, psychologists, and the Autism Society there.
Tell us about Jacob's autism as he was growing up and particularly what it meant in his day-to-day life, because it's incredibly clear from your book that Disney movies and other cartoons yeah. and drawing were an anchor to his world.
Yeah, the drawing, that helped us get out. We could go to a restaurant for 20 minutes if Jacob could bring his drawing materials. And then we could make it 30 minutes and 45 minutes because he was able to focus on the drawing, and we were able to focus on the drawing. We usually went at 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon mm. when they're just opening up. There weren't too many people there.
Yeah.
So, and this is another way. You can tell the story differently. You can tell, oh, it's very limiting, and it was at first. But you can also say Jacob guided us to the way in which we could participate in the world with him. So the early drawings, one of them was really a wonderful story, I think, for Jacob's sake, is that early on he was having trouble. He was asking us to draw something. It was the coloring of the Walt Disney Productions lettering. And we'd be coloring it, and he'd have meltdowns. And finally we realized, once he slowed us down, that he wanted a certain marker color over a certain segment of the Walt Disney Productions. And we realized that he was having us drawing the color check at the beginning of videos as it passed
yes.
from right to left to right.
Okay.
And that can seem a small thing, but it stopped the meltdowns. But it also meant that image, which was so important to him, we now understood. We had a connection. And I think the idea of yearning that comes out in the book is that we had a connection to his yearning, to what he values. And then, again, we could share that.
I'd like to turn to your daughter, Sarah, because as I was reading the book, my thoughts kept turning a lot to her. She's a little older than Jacob.
Yes.
And the excerpt I'd like you to read, this is when you and Sarah had carefully planned a library outing with Jacob. You packed all the right drawings, the right pencils for him, planned to photograph the stuffed storybook characters at the library so everybody's happy, you and Jacob and Sarah, and then you get to the library and it is closed.
At first, Jacob just wept, letting his shoulders and back hunch forward, much like the crying poses of his animated characters. But quite suddenly, he screamed, ran toward the glass windows, doors, and strengthened by his anger, nearly forced them open. Sarah stepped forward to try to comfort Jacob, but I warned her back. As we looked on, he began to scratch his face and neck, leaving streaks of red beneath the tender lines of both jaws. For the next 10 minutes or so, we coaxed him foot by foot toward and into the van. Once in the back seat, however, he flung himself down and began to kick the windows. I yelled and reached back, grabbing at his shirt and arm. And then he went after Sarah. For a moment, she shrunk back, but then she started hitting him and crying and yelling, "I hate you! I hate you!" Finally, we opened the door and let his fury back outside. On the sidewalk, Jacob kept lunging toward me, his hands intent upon scratching my face or arms. In the refuge of the van, Sarah called Mary on the cell phone, and in 10 minutes, 45 minutes from the start of his outburst, she pulled up and took Jacob home. His anger now subsiding, he began to sob. "Jacob was so sad," he said. "Jacob was so sad. Jacob was so sad." My daughter held her own kind of sorrow, and she holds it still. This sorrow has no ritual of completion, no baptism or anointing, no confirmation, no rows of chairs and cheering, no dawn or dusk in which to confess or bear witness. Who will know that in this 1 hour she held her brother's hand and felt her arms ache to comfort his desperate body, felt her voice tighten and curse, felt her fists against Jacob's chest and back, felt guilt and love and the yearning to begin anew. I want you to know what no one can know, that the wind caught Sarah's hair, held it off her face for just a moment as she sat next to me on the sidewalk, that she let her small fingers touch the blood on my forearms. I want you to imagine the many things that we leave unspoken, the memories that we must hold in faith because we do not as yet discern their meanings. And I want you to know that Sarah is still reaching out to me and that we do not yet understand the loss instilled in us and the tenacious love that wounds with so much caring.
Bruce, it would be so easy to understand if Sarah had grown up and wanted to put a lot of distance between herself and her brother. What's her relationship like today?
It's a good one. What does that mean? I think it means that at this stage in her life, Sarah has a greater understanding of what Jacob yearns for, what he desires, and his own limitations, just like I think Jacob has a sense of ours. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a tenderness that comes in the kind of relationship that Sarah has with Jacob. The difficulty early on was, in many respects, Sarah had to be a mini-parent. And our demands of Sarah, because she had to be excessively good, meant that she had greater burdens in that way. And so some of the things she lamented growing up was that when she went over to friends' houses and she played with her siblings, she recognized she didn't have that relationship with Jacob. And that was hard. But there are other stories again.
Yes.
And I think now she understands the nature of the relationship she can have, that when Jacob sees her, he will sometimes jump on her and hug her and put his nose in her face and have one of his big laughing alerts. Mm-hmm. And that's closeness.
That's Jacob's expression of closeness.
And Jacob, we're finding he misses Sarah and he's expressing it more verbally now. So it's a different place than what it was, but that's, again, one of the things that for siblings it can be difficult.
And actually any family's journey.
Yes.
Whether autism is a component of the journey or not.
And that's important because we have to connect across our differences in some way. The difference I focus on in the book is autism. But in fact, if we have connections, it takes work. Any family has to engage in that work.
The book is An Archaeology of Yearning by Bruce Mills, a memoir of their family's journey with their son, Jacob, and his autism. Bruce is a professor of English at Kalamazoo College. It was a pleasure to meet you, and thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thanks again for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Cynthia Canty. Today is the 41st anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the U.S. Supreme Court's landmark ruling that legalized abortion nationwide. And today, women's reproductive rights are in the spotlight here in Michigan. It was mid-December when state lawmakers approved a controversial new law requiring consumers to buy separate policies for abortion coverage. This means a person has to buy a rider before knowing they need an abortion. They would not be able to buy a rider after getting pregnant, and the law does not include exemptions for rape or incest. The law goes into effect in March, and there's confusion over just how it's supposed to work. Marianne Udall Phillips is director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan. Hi, Marianne.
It's great to be here.
So as I mentioned, this law is new. People are trying to figure out just how it's going to work. Is this something that the insurance industry in Michigan is prepared for?
Well, I don't really think so. I think the insurance industry is still trying to figure this law out, just like everybody else is. They've never had to deal with a situation like this, and they really don't know exactly what to do. It's complicated. It's different for the individual market and for the group market, and that's what they're trying to sort out.
Well, so let's start from the basics. Right now, does an abortion rider exist in Michigan?
So from what we can tell, there are no riders in Michigan that are specific to abortion. What happens today for many employers is if they don't want to cover abortion, they ask for that to be excluded from their benefit package. But there isn't a rider to actually cover it. It's an exclusion. Individuals can opt out for it. Sometimes they get refunds for doing that. But there isn't a separate rider for it.
So help us understand if you're buying it on a public marketplace or if it's private. How is that working?
Well, there's nothing right there out there in the public marketplace. So in the healthcare.gov, the new health insurance exchange products, there is nothing out there specifically for abortion coverage, and it is excluded right now on those exchanges. So for individuals buying coverage, they will not be able to find this kind of coverage. For groups who buy health insurance coverage as an employer, many of them have that coverage. Many of them will want to continue that coverage. There'll be sort of a mixed bag of what employers do.
Okay. So let's say come March, a woman wants to buy this rider. How will that work?
I don't think we know the answer to that question. And the health plans don't actually have to file anything with the insurance commissioner until March 13th. And I think they're all waiting to take till the very last minute to do that because they're pretty confused and they're just not sure exactly all the provisions of the law. I am predicting that for people who buy coverage for themselves, so people who buy on the individual market, which would be the health care exchange market, healthcare.gov, they're not going to find a rider for this coverage because insurance companies are always worried about what they call adverse selection. And in adverse selection, it means that people try to buy coverage for things that they think they're going to use. And if they think they're going to use it, you don't get really a mix of people in the risk pool, some who use it and some who don't. And so it makes it really not insurance coverage.
Okay, because now what I read is it's being reported that only about 3% of abortions in the state last year were actually covered by insurance. So is that this issue here that you're talking about?
Well, yes, very few abortions actually were covered by insurance last year because they're not that frequent to begin with. There's a mix of employers that have it or don't have that coverage. So it's just been a fairly small part of the health benefits generally, but for some people it's been quite important.
Sure. Now, 8 other states have similar laws like this. What are we seeing in those other states? How has it worked or not worked?
Well, we don't have a lot of information yet about those other states. We haven't really seen exactly how things have worked, but I think it is fair to say that people have less insurance coverage for abortion with a law like this.
Now, because this law was a voter-initiated law backed by Right to Life of Michigan, it means the legislature did not have time, say, to work out all of these things. Is that the biggest sticking point here?
Well, there are many sticking points in the law. There is a lack of clarity. There are many providers, many doctors who are very concerned about what this law means, especially because there are not exemptions in there. And the exemptions are really concerning to physicians. So physicians are looking for guidance on this. They're quite concerned about whether they can treat women and what is considered, you know, in this scope of this law and what is outside the scope of the law. So those are certainly issues. Some of it is a timing issue. Some of it, I think, is a philosophical issue in terms of how this law was passed.
So going forward, again, this takes place, this begins in March.
Yes.
What happens, do you think, you know, put your looking glasses on? What happens come March?
Yes, I think in March, people who buy coverage for themselves will not be able to find coverage like this. I think there will be very few, if any, health plans that offer this coverage because of the concerns about adverse risk selection. I think for employers, there'll be a mix. And, of course, the self-funded employers, the largest employers, which most people who have employer coverage get it through larger employers, they're exempt from this law because they're governed by federal law. So for them, things won't change. But for individuals and smaller groups, things could change.
Do you think that there was an understanding when this law was voted on and when voters were signing petitions? Do you think there was an understanding among them that this is what was going to happen?
I think some understood and many probably did not. We know that, you know, the governor came out and said he was opposed to this law. So we know that the governor had looked at it, and we know that he himself had many concerns, both about the nature of the law and also its interference in private business and private business decisions and transaction decisions. I think that was part of his philosophy and part of his concern about the law. So certainly some people who spoke out about the law understood it, and others, I think, did not.
Marianne Udow Phillips is director at the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan. Marianne, thank you so much.
It's great. Thank you very much, Zoe.
And we did reach out to Blue Cross Blue Shield asking them for some time on today's show. They responded that they are still working out implementation details and aren't ready to comment yet. They say because the law was enacted in mid-December, they still have things to work through so they can advise their customers. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. There's a new group in Michigan trying to bring attention to gun violence. Cindy recently spoke with Dr. Jerry Walden, a family practice physician who was named Family Physician of the Year by the Michigan Academy of Family Practice, and Dr. Andy Zweifler, an internist and an emeritus professor of internal medicine at the University of Michigan Medical School. They're part of Physicians for the Prevention of Gun Violence.
I'm interested in what spurred you, Dr. Walden, to create this group, Physicians for Prevention of Gun Violence.
Andy and I first got involved when the Virginia Tech disaster happened in 2007. There were, I think, 32 young students that got killed during that public health crisis and disaster, and we thought about what we should do and where was the physician voice, and started to question and see if we could get involved locally in making a change.
And truly, since the Virginia Tech campus shooting, there has been no shortage of one
after another. The next time it was Tucson, and we re-involved ourselves after Tucson and Gabby Giffords' shooting.
And Dr. Zweifler, with this group, what is it you're trying to do? I mean, in the sense of giving Michigan's physicians a place to speak out?
We saw it as an important educational job, but ultimately leading to some kinds of actions as a group rather than an individual voice from one or two of us.
And the idea that physicians have a perspective that few of us have as far as the results of gun violence, and you see the deaths, you see the wounded.
Absolutely.
In fact, so, I'm interested, was there a case or a patient that really you encountered in your careers that really hammered this home for you?
For me personally, yes. I lost a 15-year-old. Her name was Tamara Stewart, and Tamara died, I think, in 1995. She was just innocently at a backyard barbecue, and some guys started shooting, and she, you know, fell and died as a result of a stray bullet. I also have another patient who's spent 30 years in prison and is in prison at this time because his girlfriend used a gun to rob a woman, and she died, and he's in prison without parole. So these people are very close to me, and it was a very personal attack on to see them have these results.
As we all saw in the national conversations after Sandy Hook, there were so many political twists and turns that came up as the conversation centered on gun violence and gun control. And you say on your website that you're trying to take a consumer safety and a public health approach to gun violence. Andy, what does that mean?
The immediate kind of response is, well, let's punish the perpetrators. Let's get tough with those who have committed these acts. And don't really get at the roots of the problem. The roots of the problem, I think when you look at it, are much deeper. And you also have to look at all of the, for instance, the distribution of gun violence and how it happens. For instance, the, something like 30,000 gun deaths per year in the United States, two-thirds of them are suicides, and one-third are homicides.
And this figure is eight times the figure for Western Europe, which has the same amount of people. So it's most things in medicine, if it's 5% or 10% or even 30%, we say, oh, my gosh, we ought to intervene. But right. This is eight times. We're the only outlier that's anywhere close to this, which is one of the reasons. And it's really too many guns. We went from 200 million to 300 million in a space of 15 years from 1994 to 2005. We added 100 million guns. So we've got too many guns and too weak laws, and the combination makes us eight times more likely to have a gun death. And it's not that we're more violent. Most of us think that we're mm-hmm. a violent country, but we're equally violent to all the other European countries on all kinds of bases of studies and burglaries. All kinds of other crimes are equal.
So how can organizing physicians, as you're doing with this group, Physicians for the Prevention of Gun Violence, what can you do to really cut down on gun violence and make a real difference in Michigan?
We, first of all, need to have a voice, because gun deaths are equal to automobile deaths, are equal to flu. They're the two major other epidemics that we are looking at currently. So it's a huge opportunity for physicians to get involved. So if we have a voice, which mostly there hasn't been a real good physician voice, and if we can start to affect legislation, if we can start to affect how guns are distributed, that you can't buy an infinite number of guns at one time, as you currently can in Michigan, that you have better laws. And if we start to maybe affect the producers, the guns can be personalized so that only one person can fire them, can be made a lot safer. And we can also make guns traceable so that if you shoot somebody with your gun, you can tell who's by marking, micro-marking the bullets. There's a lot of things that can happen. We have to look and see what opportunities are. Right now, the opportunities are mostly to organize. So we're looking for other physicians to join us. We have a website. We have our organization is ppgv.org. So we want other doctors around the state to get on board.
Well, also, I'd like to add to that, there are other things physicians can do in their practice. Mm-hmm. Suicide prevention is a big one. The three things that I keep emphasizing when I have an opportunity to talk to docs is if there's a depressed person that you're dealing with, family needs to know and that person needs to know that a gun in the house is not a good idea. And similarly, when there is intimate partner violence going on, the evidence is very clear that if there's a gun around, there's a real possibility that the battered person is going to get shot and maybe killed. So again, in that situation, the doctor has an opportunity to bring that subject up and see if they can get guns out of the house in that situation.
Can I just jump in there? And I'm curious with HEPA laws, what they are, and the privacy concerns where we're not even allowed to let our signatures be seen as we're signing in the office. Mm-hmm. Can you, as a physician, when this situation presents itself, go to the police and say, I think we've got a problem here? Are you allowed?
No, I don't think you can go to the police. Jerry, yeah. You might want to comment on that. Personally, I'd say in the case of such as the Sandy Hook situation,
yes,
where there is a person who looks like they are a potential for being a violent a person and killing people with a gun, then I think there is a responsibility of the doc. And I'd say a responsibility that's a legal responsibility.
Can you take this public health approach that you're advocating for gun violence, and can that coexist with
with people's desires to exercise their Second Amendment rights to own guns.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. We're looking at this as a public health issue. If we make guns as safe as they can be, and we would certainly hope that both sides, the Republicans and Democrats, are get involved, because both sides have kids and want to protect them. So we need to just make these guns as safe as possible, make them limited to one owner being able to fire it, try to limit the amount, the use of the guns. It's absolutely the safest not to have a gun in your house. The studies have shown that it's, you know, you're 2 to 3 times at least more likely to get to shoot a family member. But if you're going to do it, make it safe. Lock it up. Keep it controlled, and personalize it. So that it's your gun and you're the only one that's going to shoot it.
And I think I hear you saying don't hesitate to share concerns. It makes one wonder when we talk about Sandy Hook that if people in that orbit of Adam Lanza's family, whether it was a physician, another family member had spoken out and had tried. I don't know if the word whistleblowing is right. Some might say it is whistleblowing.
I think it's having that voice, and any kind of it's whistleblowing, it's standing up, it's speaking out. We have to do better, and you know, especially because those are all precious children and great teachers that died. We can't lose people just every day like we are right now.
The group is Physicians for the Prevention of Gun Violence, active throughout Michigan. Their website is ppgv.org. And again, as you say, you are looking for physicians, physician assistants, medical professionals to on board.
Yes.
Dr. Jerry Walden, Dr. Andy Zweifler, are the co-founders of Physicians for the Prevention of Gun Violence. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And that's Stateside for this cold, cold Wednesday. The show was directed today by Mercedes Mejia, engineered by Bob Scon. We had help from Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Katie Suha, and Claire Tennisgetter. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in today for Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.